Slavery is back.
Welcome to a place where private business profit from a captive labour force, yet pennies are spent on medical services to a population in which the Indigenous, the poor and the mentally ill are overrepresented. Where isolation, humiliation and degradation are facts of life. Welcome to prison.
It depends who's telling the story, I suppose. The prisoners would have one view, the people who work in the prison system would have another, and I think it's up to people to decide where the truth is.
Give government propaganda and the media spin doctors the flick, and check out Doin' Time for news, views and tunes on prison issues from Guantanamo Bay to Christmas Island to prisons and detention centres everywhere, every Monday at 4 p.m. on your community radio, 3CR.
We are still fired up and we're still talking about revolution.
Hello and welcome to the Doin' Time Show. This is 3CR Community Radio, 855 AM on the dial, streaming live on www.3cr.org.au. This episode of Doin' Time contains audio descriptions of Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people who have died and graphic discussion of deaths in custody and massacres. We're going to be starting off the show with a very special guest, Ethan Floyd, who was a participant on the flotilla, and he is going to speak to us about his experiences, about what happened, and also talk about what's happening, the plight of Gaza and what people have suffered there at the hands of the Israeli government. Ethan is a Wiradjuri, First Nations activist, and he'll talk about what land he's on. And then after that, Ethan is going to stay for the whole show, and he's going to talk about the flotilla and some of the torture that he experienced, and also talk about Gaza. But we're going to be speaking with Jeanette, who will join us later, and Jeanette will speak to us in regards to what has been happening with the students of Palestine and some of the freedoms that have been taken off them in terms of protest and freedom of speech at Sydney University. So we'll talk about that as well. Hello, Ethan. Welcome to the program.
Thanks, Marissa. Good to be with you and your listeners today.
It's lovely to have you. So, Ethan, first of all, can you just tell us, because we like to, whenever there's a First Nations person in the studio, we like to know what land they're from. Can you just tell us that?
Yeah, and that's the way I was taught to, is introduce yourself.
Absolutely.
So I'm a Wiradjuri and Wailwan person from New South Wales. I come from a place called Galagambone, which is a place with a really strong Aboriginal community. It's a place where all my ancestors came from. And importantly, when Pemulwuy from Badamudigal put out the call to clans all to the west to come and help him fight that fight against the British and that guerrilla warfare against colonisation, I was proud that my ancestors are among those who answered that call and came and fought against colonisation.
Absolutely. So you were on the flotilla, and basically you were part of that crew. Can you tell us about why and how you ended up on the flotilla, and how many other boats were with you, and just basically give us a detailed, analysis of what happened and how you felt and what you experienced, because I imagine you would have gone through a lot of trauma.
Yeah, so the flotilla is a non-violent civilian humanitarian mission. So we're not combatants, we don't carry any weapons, we sail across the Mediterranean in a fleet of, this time about 100 boats. And our goal really is to deliver humanitarian aid to Gaza by breaking Israel's naval blockade of the region. So for the past 19 years, Israel has kept Gaza under a siege, which has been declared time and time again illegal under international law. And so the purpose of this mission and missions like it is to break by sea the naval blockade, the siege of Gaza, and prove to the world, but also governments crucially around the world, that it can be done, that we can force and facilitate the free flow of aid at scale into Gaza where it's needed. So it's in that context that I joined the flotilla. I joined for a lot of reasons. You know, pretty simply, my mum, a really staunch, proud black woman, taught me from a very early age that if you see somebody in trouble, you help them. And then you don't just do that when it's easy. You don't just do it when it's convenient or when there's something in it for you. You always help people in trouble because it's always the right thing to do. And I think that principle applies whether you're, you know, in the playground at primary school and seeing a kid get picked on, or whether you're seeing a live stream genocide play out on your phone. No matter what situation you're in, if you're in a position to help people, you should always do it. So that's why I joined the flotilla. It's also about using, you know, my privileges and my parts of my identity that are so important to me. You know, First Nations people resisted and have fought a genocide here on this continent. And so we know when it's happening elsewhere, and we can recognize the same things being done to Palestinians by Israel that were done to us by the British and by the Euro colonists. So we can recognize that. I'm also a student, and that's really important because no matter where you look throughout history, students have always been there on the front lines of social struggles. We can talk about the freedom rides in 1965 that left from the front lawns of my university in Sydney. You can talk about the movement to end the war in Vietnam and end conscription of young people into the war in Vietnam. You can talk about the South African apartheid. You can talk about the US wars in Iraq and Afghanistan. Pick a social struggle, and you'll see students among workers and ordinary people helping to lead the charge on that movement. So it's you know, no different when we talk about Gaza and the genocide that's being perpetrated by Israel, that students have a really important role to play in resisting that and I think really simply calling out the idea that we should allow Israel to act with complete impunity. So in terms of what we experienced, we set sail from a port in Sicily, in the south of Italy. We set sail from a port called Augusta.
And you were one of 17 Australians?
One of 17 Australians, yeah. And we were joined by other really staunch First Nations people. We had, not sailing with us, but with us in port, Jaden Kitchener-Waters, who's a proud musician, First Nations musician from Newcastle. We had Sam Weeper-Watson, grandson of Sam Watson of the Brisbane Blacks, and you know, plenty of really staunch Australians who were with us in you know, our struggles at home, and obviously the struggle against Israel's genocide. So we set sail in late April, and we had quite a while to go. We had about 2 weeks of sailing across the Mediterranean Sea to get to Gaza, and about 4 days into our journey, you know, more than a week from our destination, we started to get reports coming through our radios one night that we were having, you know, military drones that were circling our fleet. They were getting quite close. They were shining spotlights on us. And a couple of hours later, we started to hear reports that there were these small tugboats and small military vessels that were getting quite close to our sailboats. We didn't know what was going on, to be honest. We weren't expecting to see the Israelis for, you know, at least a week. So we were quite confused. We thought it might be the Greeks. We thought it might be NATO forces that were trying to turn us away. But what really drove it home for us, for the people on my boat, was we started to get our cameras and our radios jammed, and all our communications were shut down through frequencies that were being broadcast from these military vessels. And we know from the last flotilla that the Israelis jammed radio communications with songs from ABBA, and they did the same thing to us on the water. So that's when we really, when we realized that this is these are the Israelis who are intercepting us. And the thing that really blew us all away was that we were more than 600 nautical miles, and that's about, you know, 1,000 or so kilometers from Israel. They came all this way across the Mediterranean to harass our boats, to intercept us, to pick us up, and to kidnap us from the middle of the Mediterranean. So, you know, everybody's experience is different, and the level of treatment, you know, differed from boat to boat. I can tell you that on my boat, we had an interaction with a smaller warship, an Israeli warship. We came up from the cabin and we saw this big spotlight scanning across the ocean, sort of like scanning for boats, and all of a sudden it locked onto us, and then we started to see the spray coming up behind the boat as it you know, motored towards us. It got quite close and then it turned its spotlight off so it could deploy a small inflatable boat that they could use to board us, the Israeli commandos. As soon as they dropped that light, my crew and I looked at each other and sort of gave ourselves the nod and said, "Are we doing this?" And we said, "Yeah, we're doing this." So we jumped back in the cockpit and took off at full speed, and we were able to evade the Israelis for about another 45 minutes.
Wow.
You know, that turned out to be, you know, that really irked the Israelis. So, you know, when our engine gave way and we were boarded again by the Israelis, they dealt out quite a lot of violence to us on board. I identified myself as the spokesperson for the boat, so I told the rest of my crew, "Don't answer any questions, don't talk to the Israelis," and spoke to the Israelis and said, "You know, if you have any questions, you can ask them to me, but leave the rest of these people alone." And so I was separated from my crew and taken to the front of the boat, and I was interrogated for about 15 minutes, and they were interested in things like, you know, who is the captain. They were asking about different people who were on the flotilla, people with high profiles like Tiago Avila from Spain, from Brazil, sorry, I should say, and Saif Abukashek, a Palestinian from Spain. These are two very high-profile people who were on the flotilla, and the Israelis were really interested in finding these people. So,
Did you handle that interrogation?
It was pretty brutal. We'd been trained really well. We'd gone through weeks and weeks of training in nonviolence, in how to resist torture, in how to respond when you are having an interaction with an Israeli commando. But it was still pretty grueling. I mean, they would ask a question, and if I had, you know, refused to answer the question, or if I answered the question in a way in which they thought was, you know, unsatisfactory, then I'd be beaten. And that could come, you know, with a kick to the guts, a kick to the ribs, punched in the upper arms and in the head quite a few times. And was sort of thrown around the boat by my hair, which had grown quite long, during the time in port and on the water. So, you know, it was beyond the pale of what anyone should expect to be treated. But we know that this is just a drop in the ocean compared to how Palestinians compared to how Israelis treat Palestinians. And how Palestinians are treated, not just in Israeli prisons, but just in everyday interactions with Israeli soldiers and security authorities in Gaza and in the West Bank. And that was what was front of mind for all of us, is we were constantly aware that if Palestinians can go through almost 80 years of occupation, of genocide, of military bombardment, of settler violence, of all the horrors that the Israeli military and Israeli society deal out to Palestinians, if they can cop that for 80 years and still be able to get up each morning and resist and live and continue under those conditions, then, you know, what excuse do I have not to muscle through 20 minutes of beatings? And that's what we all felt, was we're in an incredibly privileged position, and if we're not using that privilege to do something which we think is right and good and will help other people, then, you know, what are we doing?
Well, you came back alive, you've come back intact. But I imagine that a lot of people, let's give a shout out to Neve, actually, who's from Melbourne, isn't she?
Yes.
And was on the ship and is still recovering.
Yeah. So we had a really wide range of experiences when we were held on the Israeli prison boat. This was a military warship, and they'd constructed for us out of shipping containers an enclosure on the boat, and we were held there for 3 days. And all of us went through, a lot of really awful treatment from the Israelis. Three of my friends were shot by the Israelis with rubber bullets. It's important to shout out as well, you know.
Absolutely.
A rubber bullet is not a bullet-shaped piece of rubber. A rubber bullet is a steel pellet that is just coated with rubber, so it still pierces the skin and it still causes a flesh wound. And I watched over the 3 days we were on that prison ship as those people with bullet wounds because they were denied access to a doctor and they were denied medical care, their wounds became really infected and really badly infected, so that by the time we were able to see a doctor, the doctors were shocked at the condition of their treatment and the condition of their wounds. People were bashed, people were menaced with guns. The Israelis used flashbang grenades against us. These are grenades that, you know, even in daylight, they flash so bright that they can blind you and deafen you for, you know, minutes at a time. And they're used to sort of stun and disorient you. We were kept in conditions that were, you know, during the day, it was blisteringly hot. Because we were on board on the deck of the ship in the middle of the Mediterranean summer. At nighttime, the Israelis would flood the floor of the enclosure with seawater and hose everybody down. So people were shivering and you know, in hypothermic conditions, and basically just, you know, hugging each other just to conserve body heat. So it was really rough conditions, and that was what our life was like for 3 days before we were thrown off the military boat and given over to the Greek Coast Guard. So yeah, I mean, there are people who've come back from this flotilla who are still recovering, who are still working on their injuries. You know, I'm working on you know, sort of head trauma medical care. I had my head bashed against the side of a shipping container 8 times by an Israeli soldier while I was on board, and that left me concussed in the moment, and it's left me with some head trauma that you know is sort of treatment ongoing, and you know, my story is not unique by any means. It's, you know, we had 186 people on that boat with us, and I can tell you each and every one have come away from this experience with ongoing medical conditions and injuries that are going to stay with them for a while.
And are you having medications for that head trauma?
Yeah, so all through our medical checkups, I took a course of sort of really codeine painkillers for about 3 weeks, and you know, most of the other participants have been on different medications and different medical treatments. Because the severity of their injuries is so great.
Okay, well, that is absolutely disgraceful conduct. It's a violation of human rights. And I'm just so proud of you that you've come on and talked about this interview. I've taken heaps of notes just before the interview, and I'm not even using them because I just feel like it's so important with these interviews now to talk from the heart. Mm. It's approximately 4:18, and you're listening to the Do and Time show on 3CR, in case you've just tuned in. And we're speaking with Ethan Floyd, who participated in the global Smooth Flotilla of more than 100 boats that was intercepted in the Mediterranean Sea, attempting to breach the Israeli naval blockade of Gaza. And I did read that one. Now, Ethan, pretty soon... we're going to be, as you know, we're going to be joined by Jeanette, who is a student who's been participating quite a lot in the genocide with Palestine. And I want you to feel free to join our discussion. And Jeanette is also aware as well that you're on the show too, I believe.
Mm, yeah, I know Jeanette well through student organising, and the work that these folks do in Sydney University is amazing. I mean, we've seen over the last 3 years universities around the country, but I think particularly at Sydney University, take really unprecedented steps to shut down pro-Palestine solidarity, to silence people, yep, and to intimidate people, students and staff, who are speaking up for Palestine. And that's come in the form of, you know, banning bake sales, which are raising funds for families in Gaza, or outlawing certain symbols like the Handala symbol, which is that cartoon of the Palestinian child with their hands behind their back. And the university used these attempts to silence and intimidate students as a way to make pro-Palestine activism seem dirty, seem like something that's risky. You know, at the end of the day, most of these disciplinary charges are dropped, but the effect it has in just bringing the charges means that every student now will think twice before they sign a petition or join a protest or share something on social media for fear that the university could threaten them with suspension or with expulsion or with whatever, just for having a political opinion. And, you know, a political opinion which I think is a right one. But it's really grim. It spells trouble for freedom of speech, for academic freedom, and for the values that we should expect to think about at universities. You know, universities should be places where we place heavy stock in truth and in inquiry and with thinking critically. But the university administration and the management look at these values and they throw them in the bin and they say, we actually don't care about those things. All we care about is appeasing those lobby groups and those government groups who are putting pressure on us to crack down on activism. And you know, you'll hear from Jeanette that it's shameful.
Indeed. And Jeanette is actually a student activist and member of Students Against War, and she's been involved in organising in the Palestine movement on campus. But before we go to that interview, just wanted to, because I know we were speaking off air, about a wound that had maggots on it, and I believe it was a New Zealander. And just before we launch into that, there is I'll issue another content warning that there have been audio images of torture.
Yes, yeah. And, you know, you can't describe the treatment of flotilla activists by Israelis as anything other than torture. We were, during our time in custody, we were made to sit in stress positions. These are torture positions that have been designed specifically to cause pain and discomfort. To put you in positions that cut off your blood flow to your limbs, to give you that sort of pins and needles sensation that's so uncomfortable. And you're forced to remain in these positions for hours on end. So one of the most common ones was to kneel on your kneecaps on the ground, cross your ankles over one another, interlace your fingers behind your head, and keep your forehead pressed against the ground at all times. And you are made to stay in that position exactly. And if you shifted or wriggled or tried to, you know, move into a more comfortable position, you would either get, you know, a kick to the guts or a kick to the ribs, or in many cases, including myself and others, you would feel a pressing into either the base of your skull or the small of your back near your tailbone, the muzzle of one of the Israelis' automatic rifles. And they would push that into you really hard until you moved back into the position they'd put you in. And you know, there were people who were in those positions for so long that they just collapsed and rolled over from exhaustion. And when they did that, they were bashed and they were beaten by the Israelis. So it was really, like properly torturous treatment. And that was just one example of how the hospitality we were shown by the Israelis.
And obviously, just so the listeners do have a little bit of history of what the flotilla is, the flotilla is basically going into international waters trying to deliver life-saving aid to starving civilians in Gaza. That's right, isn't it?
Yeah, and I mean, it's an action that is entirely protected by international law, by international humanitarian treaties that, among others, Australia has signed on to and Australia has committed itself to uphold. And and despite this, we've seen time and time again, the Australian government will refuse to condemn the actions of Israelis, whether it's with regards to the treatment of Palestinians or whether it's with regards to the treatment of Australian citizens. Our government refuses to front up to the challenge to take on head-on the idea that Israel should be allowed to act with zero consequences and zero punishment for torturing Australian citizens, for torturing hundreds of international activists, and for torturing Palestinians. I mean, when we were let go by the Israelis, we were leaving behind more than 10,000 Palestinian prisoners who were held in Israeli military prisons, often without charge on administrative detention for years and years and years. There are people, Palestinians, who go into these prisons and they disappear into these prisons. They never return. Kitziot Prison, where many flotilla activists were held, it's a place in the Negev Desert. It's been described by international organizations as a laboratory of cruelty, where the Israelis test out new torture techniques, which they then roll out in the treatment of Palestinians across the region. You know, it was shut down in the 90s because the practices of the guards there violated the Geneva Conventions. And it was reopened, and it's still open today. And we know from recent reports, both from Palestinian groups and from the flotilla, that Kitziot is a place where torture and rape are used as tools, as carceral tools, by prison guards and by security forces. And I think that, you know, any government who sees all of these cards on the table and sees their citizens being treated like this by a foreign government who we want to keep calling a friend and an ally, any government who doesn't have the guts to stand up and call that out and say we actually won't tolerate that by any country, I think is a weak government that we should turf out.
Absolutely. It's approximately 4:26 and we've got about 4 minutes left until our show, the rest of the show, and we're going to be speaking with Jeanette. But yeah, it beggars belief, doesn't it? And afterwards, after we have our interview with Jeanette, it would be really good to talk about what happened when you refused to leave the boat, because I understand you didn't go to an Israeli prison. But let's have a couple of minutes break and we'll play an announcement.
We're celebrating 50 years of 3CR on Saturday the 4th of July at Collingwood Town Hall. There'll be stalls, displays, great food, performances, activities, prizes, and so much more. It's a birthday for us and we can't wait to celebrate with you. Saturday the 4th of July, Collingwood Town Hall, 11 a.m. till 4 p.m. Bring your family, tell your friends, all are welcome. 3CR, celebrating 50 years.
Let us know you're coming. Go to Humanitics and search for 3CR to RSVP.
3CR, celebrating 50 years.
Throughout the month of June, we're asking you to support fierce, independent and community-controlled media by making a donation to our Radiothon.
We'll be taking donations online, over the phone and in the station to help keep 3CR going for another year.
To donate, go to 3cr.org.au, call the station on 03 9419 8377
or drop in at 21 Smith Street, Fitzroy during business hours.
3CR, celebrating 50 years.
Did you know that 3CR first went to air in 1976? That's right, we're turning 50 this year.
Good afternoon and welcome to 3CR, and yes, we've finally done it at last. We're at our new studios in Cromwell Street, Collingwood, and the new, brand spanking new transmitter just north of the Collingwood Town Hall. We're glad to be here, we're very glad to be here, and I think everybody in the studio will agree with me there. And we'll be bringing you our regular Saturday program, we hope, without any hitches. So, on this inaugural day at our new site, we welcome you and hope you'll enjoy the programs that'll be coming your way.
3CR, celebrating 50 years.
And you're back with the Doin' Time show. And I still have Ethan here. And we've been talking a lot about what's been happening on the flotilla. And pretty soon we're going to be speaking very shortly with Jeanette, who is a student activist, a member of Students Against War. And she's been involved in the organising of the Palestinian movement on campus. And as I said in my intro, so we'll be speaking with her shortly. Hello, Jeanette. Welcome to the program.
Hi, Marissa. How are you?
Good, thank you. It's lovely to hear from you and joining us in the studio. We've also got Ethan, who has been speaking to us about what happened to him on the flotilla.
Hello.
Yeah. Hey, Ethan. Thank you so much again for having me involved. I was just tuning in right before this, and yeah, I'm really keen to be involved in the discussion.
Absolutely. Can you start off by talking about the genocide of Palestine and what's been happening with the student activists and what happened at Sydney Uni?
Yeah, as I said, I was following the conversation before getting on this call, and I really want to echo what Ethan was saying earlier with, I suppose, the central role of student activism and the role that students have historically played in leading social movements against, whether it be the war on Vietnam, Iraq, you know, opposing South African apartheid. I mean, putting that into context, it just makes it, all the more chilling and appalling when we look at the level of repression, you know, the extent of our university's crackdown on the activism for Palestine. Also, within that context, our university, it's important to highlight, maintains extensive, deep ties with both Israeli institutions, Israeli universities, as well as maintains significant research ties in weapons manufacturing companies such as Lockheed Martin, Thales, Safran, all of which profit massively from the genocide currently being carried out in Gaza. I think that all kind of contextualizes the type of repression, the crackdown on activism that we see, that it makes sense that our university management needs to normalize its complicity in what's happening in Gaza, what's happening with the violent occupation in the West Bank. UCID has to normalize its complicity in that by criminalizing students for speaking up about that, creating, as Ethan so well mentioned, this intimidation that makes it difficult for staff and students to speak out. And just to kind of add on to what Ethan has already mentioned in terms of those types of repressive policies, it was in June of 2024, following the Gaza Solidarity encampment at the University of Sydney, that management brought in what is now notoriously known as the campus access policy. Now, this is a policy that makes it incredibly difficult to hold a protest, to set up a stall on campus, put up posters without the university's approval. It's a huge imposition on our freedom to protest, to do these fundamental acts of activism on campus. This campus access policy has been used to shut down bake sales for families in Palestine, as well as has been used to threaten suspension of a student in one case last year from writing on a whiteboard from the river to the sea. This was an international student who faced having her student visa revoked if the university was successful in suspending her. It's quite grim, kind of the level of repression that we're facing. I think, as well as Ethan mentioned, the most recent case against the two students who were putting up posters using the Hamdallah symbol, you know, a graphic cartoon of a Palestinian boy, is just entirely, quite evident of the level of repression that students face on campus. But I would really invite Ethan to feed in any of his experiences with it too. And anything else that I could be missing from this picture.
Before you do that, Ethan, I wanted to also, and I'm sure you would second this, Jeanette, and all listeners, that the amazing work that the Flotilla activists have done on the ship, and the amazing work that you and the students have done. It's interconnected, which is why I invited you and Ethan onto the show at the same time, because I felt like it was interconnected, because we've got Ethan talking about what happened to him and others on the Flotilla, and also talking to you. That is also a form of torture as well, having your freedoms violated.
Yeah, thank you for highlighting that, Marissa. I think, as Ethan said earlier, there, you know, our experience on campus pales in comparison to the experience of those on the flotilla that were, you know, illegally abducted by the Israeli forces.
It's still bad, though.
Of course.
Go.
I mean, it does. It just makes it, you know, all the more outrageous that, our university, they raised these disciplinary threats, you know, sent letters to students for putting up posters that are protesting against our ties with Israeli institutions. The university claims that these are civil institutions, you know, that it's an attack and some sort of, you know, collective blame that we're trying to incite by protesting our ties to those universities. But clearly we can see that, yeah, these are not neutral institutions. Like, these are institutions that are deeply embedded to all of the crimes that we see facing, whether it's the flotilla activists or those that are trying to survive in Gaza, those under violent occupation in the West Bank. And
absolutely.
Yeah, it's important for students and staff to come out in solidarity of those victims and to point out the complicity that our university has in, yeah, supporting that the state of Israel that's committing those crimes.
And what do you think, Ethan, about all this?
Yeah, like, can I say, I think Marissa, you and Jeanette both make the same really good point, which is that whether we are working and struggling on our university campuses or on the high seas or in our communities, in our workplaces, wherever we're doing Palestine solidarity work, it is not just connected struggles, it's the same struggle, but it's just being fought on different fronts. And part of what makes global actions like the flotilla so important, you know, despite or outside of, you know, the stated goals of getting aid to Gaza and breaking the siege, what we really hope to do is to reinforce the movements back home in our own countries. I mean, for every one person who was on the flotilla from more than 80 countries, for each person there are thousands or tens of thousands or hundreds of thousands of people back in their home countries who are supporting the work that they're doing. And I've said it often, is that, you know, when we're on the Mediterranean, we are sailing on their winds. It's their work back in our own backyards that enable us to take action globally and take action straight to Palestine. And, I mean, we know something really important about all of this, which is that one global action like the flotilla is not what's going to end the genocide in Gaza. What is going to end the genocide in Gaza is if we can work to unpick the systems which support that genocide, and those systems exist in our own backyards. They exist, you know, back in New South Wales, in Sydney, on Wangal country and on Buttermuttigal country, where I live, near Western Sydney. There are weapons factories, munitions factories, which produce parts for F-35 fighter jets. And these parts are shipped to Israel. These parts are shipped to Israel where they are used in the construction of military planes and military jets, which then drop bombs on Palestinians. So, you know, if you want to follow the thread back from a crater in Gaza to the origin of these military technologies, that thread leads back to Australia. It leads, like Jeanette says, back to the research of students at universities like Sydney University, research into heat mapping, which is part of, you know, demography studies, that's then applied in a military aspect for targeting systems. And weapons companies take this research, produce this technology, and then go to weapons expos and market it as quote-unquote battle-tested. We know what that means. It means tested on innocent civilian populations in Gaza. So we can't pretend, and I don't think anyone can get away with pretending anymore, that you know, this is just some far-off issue on the other side of the world that we can easily ignore. I mean, the systems which enable this genocide exist within arm's reach of us. So for anybody with any doubt, I mean, we have weapons factories in the west of Sydney, in New South Wales, in the Illawarra. We have companies like Bisalloy. Bisalloy produces this really rare product of hardened steel, which is then used for the armoured exteriors of Israeli military vehicles. So we have an obligation, I think, as people who live in Australia, in this place, to recognize the complicity that exists here, whether it's willing or not. There is a complicity that exists in our communities. We have to recognize it, and then we have to go, okay, what can we do about it? How do we feel empowered to take action? And so one other reason, which is why I was involved in the flotilla, is I joined in the first place because I was inspired by the work of others, whether it's other flotilla activists or whether it's people in Gaza ordinary people with a camera, with a phone, with the means to resist occupation. That's who I draw inspiration from. So by joining an action like this, I want people back home to think, well, you know, if this 22-year-old can go and get on a boat, can sail the Mediterranean and try and break Israel's naval blockade, can challenge the military and try and punch through a siege, if this guy can do that, then what's stopping me from going down to, you know, my local weapons factory, getting up on a tripod, or locking onto the gate, or performing direct action at a weapons factory? Or what's to stop me from getting in touch with my local MUA or my wharfies union and going down to a port, and when Zim Shipping comes through with cargo for Israel, or when MSC comes through with cargo for Israel, shut down the port with the wharfies? Yeah. Or, you know, what's to stop me from writing a letter to my MP? These things are all a part of this massive ecosystem of actions we can take. And it's all about doing what you can where you are. But the first step is just do something.
Exactly. Yeah. And, you know, this is so good, because it's actually hoping that listeners are going to really listen to what's happening and go out there and do things.
I completely agree with everything that Ethan has echoed. Like, the fight for Palestine actually starts at home, you know, whether that's on the streets, in the workplaces, or on campus. And I think, the fight that we have on campus for Palestine is fundamentally linked to our resistance against the repression, our fight against the repression that's trying to silence those protests. You know, the resistance that we need in order to protect our freedom to protest, to hold stalls, to actually, put on the forums with Palestinians, with Palestinian academics and universities, to shed light on the education system that's being disrupted in Gaza.
Jeanette, I just wanted to ask you, sorry to interrupt. I wanted to ask you, did the university drop disciplinary proceedings against the two students over the Palestinian solidarity poster calling for no exchange with Israeli apartheid?
Yes, I was actually going to, completely bring it back to that. Like, we...
No, it's all right.
We have to kind of come back to what we can do to take on and to resist the repression that we have on that management has against us. And the truth is, staff and students have repeatedly defied whether that be the campus access policy or build these very broad, sweeping support defense campaigns for students, such as the two students who were facing disciplinary threats. And yes, after having a petition that we put out that got over 800 supporters to sign on to that open letter, you know, including some very prominent politicians, journalists, union representatives, we held a protest that we had Ethan Floyd speak at, as well as Wendy Bacon. The university was forced to completely concede that the call for a boycott of those universities, as the posters were doing, had anything to do with the anti-Semitic claims of anti-Semitism that they had initially tried to use to discipline the students.
The university specifically object to?
The university had in its disciplinary letter that calling for the cut exchange programs with the Israeli universities was targeting civil institutions, that the use of the Handala symbol, which is, as I said, the graphic cartoon of the Palestinian boy, may be deemed in certain contexts as anti-Semitic by certain individuals. Now, this falls in line with the most recent definition of anti-Semitism that the University of Sydney brought in last year, which conflates anti-Zionism with anti-Semitism. And yes, it's based on the IHRA definition, or in other words, the International Holocaust Remembrance Alliance definition, which states that criticism of Israel may be deemed as anti-Semitic. So these are the claims that the university was forced to draw back, forced to completely concede as a mistake because of the broad sweep, the broad swell of support that we were able to garner for defense of the students, and to point out the hypocrisy and the ludicrousy, if you will, of the management's attempts at disciplining the students.
Jeanette, I really appreciate you telling us that, because at least there's something positive that did come out of it. You know that it was dropped. However, it shouldn't have happened in the first place, and I'm sure that other instances will happen. It's approximately 4:45, Jeanette. What I'd really like to do now is we're going to have to conclude your interview, but I would really love for you to come back at some stage in the next couple of weeks, so that we can do some further updates and look at your work in the work of the group. Is that okay?
That sounds absolutely brilliant. There's so much more that I'm keen to share.
Oh, no, there's a lot more.
We cover so much in a few minutes, hey, but I've really enjoyed the discussion. Thank you, Marissa. Thank you, Ethan, for, such a fruitful discussion. I would love to continue at some point.
Let's do that, because it's ongoing. And, in fact, 3CR actually has our radiothon coming up. The Do and Time show has to actually raise $1,000. This prison show is actually providing a safe place for marginalised communities to come together and discuss things. But we also shine a spotlight on torture and in particular, Palestine. So I think, Jeanette, what I'm saying is it's important that you come back and we do some follow-up interviews about this, because it's ongoing.
Yeah, that sounds great. Yeah.
Any final comments before we finish?
Yeah, I mean, it would be really good to, chat through some of the other wins that we've been able to achieve. I guess one that I'll kind of leave off with for a positive note is, that actually having staff and students consistently defy the campus access policy, hold protests, hold snap rallies, put up the posters, announcing lectures. Like, that's actually a type of campaign that we built in order to cut one of the exchange programs with the Bezalel Art Academy in Israel. We were actually able to successfully do that in February of last year. That was the first ever tie, a huge win for the BDS movement. That was the first ever tie that we were able to cut in any university in Australia. And it just kind of shows the need to continue to stand up against the repression, continue the fight for Palestine on our own grounds without being criminalized, without being silenced, without being intimidated. So I hope that leaves off a positive note for the
interview. No, this is fantastic. And I hope that you didn't feel, emotionally shortchanged by finishing the interview a bit earlier.
No, absolutely not. I really enjoyed having that discussion. Thank you so much for having me on again.
Oh, it was great to have you, and we'll talk to you in a couple of weeks.
That sounds great.
Thanks a lot, Jeanette. Marissa. Okay.
Thank you.
Bye-bye. And that was Jeanette, who is a student activist and member of Students Against War, who's been involved in organising in the Palestine movement on campus. So important, Ethan, all this, isn't it?
Absolutely. I mean, the student movement, I think, has been so strong. And I mean, not just the student movement, but the staff movement as well at universities. These are places where, there's such a strength of sharing opinions, of robust debate of issues that are so important. And I think Palestine has really become one of the issues where university students and staff have led. And have been able to not only expose the ties between our educational institutions and this genocide that's ongoing in Gaza, but put forward, I think, a really compelling case for how do we fight back, and how do we work to unpick that complicity and make it make it impossible for universities to profit and benefit from the genocide of Palestinians. And what people like Jeanette and what people like, all the students and staff at universities across this country are doing is to make Israel the worst bet you could ever make, to make Israel the worst investment you could ever put your money into. And, part of how we've done this in historical terms is with South Africa is creating the conditions for boycotts and for economic sanctions and for the isolation of a rogue state. And Israel is a really similar case, because when we are able to target our economic and our financial ties to a state, it puts us in a good position to turn that state, as it should be, into a pariah state, into a state where no country wants to do business with it and no country wants to get involved and touch that country. So, really, really massive shout out to the work of Jeanette, of students at Sydney Uni and students at universities across this country.
Beautiful. So we're going to have another announcement and then we'll come back.
What's taking place in Palestine is horrendous.
Here are some ways that you can keep yourself informed and involved.
Listen in to Palestine Remembered every Saturday morning at 9:30 a.m. or listen to the podcast.
Join the APAN mailing list at apan.org.au for updates, news about actions you can get involved in, and where you can donate to provide humanitarian assistance.
Listen to other news and current affairs programs on 3CR that also cover Palestine.
The oppression of the Palestinian people has been going on for 75 years. It has to stop. You can be part of making that happen by staying informed and active.
APAN is a proud supporter of 3CR.
And you're listening to the Doin' Time show, 3CR. And I'm speaking with Ethan, who was on the flotilla. So, Ethan, it was quite timely, wasn't it, to speak to Jeanette about what was happening at the Sydney University, and it's good that those disciplinary proceedings have been dropped. But moving forward from that, and we will speak to her in the future, just wanted to talk to you a little bit more about what happened on the flotilla. And when you were nearing the end, actually, before we talk about that, you were mentioning about the disco music with the torture there. What happened there?
Yeah, so this was from the second lot of people, a lot of activists who were taken not just on board the prison ship where I was, but were taken all the way to Israel and held in a place called Ketziot Prison. We were hearing accounts of Israeli prison torture techniques being used there as well. And one of them, which we already have accounts of from Palestinian detainees and those who have been released from Israeli prisons, is something which is almost kind of sarcastically referred to by the Israelis as the disco room. And it's a windowless room where detainees are taken and music is played so loud over the loudspeakers that people's eardrums burst and bleed. And they are subjected to noise nuisance, to auditory torture, whilst they're beaten and maimed by Israelis. And we have, there's numerous accounts of this being done to Palestinians, and returned flotilla activists also report and share with us their experiences, which is a similar technique being used, which is being locked in a room, being subjected to auditory torture whilst being beaten. And I think what it really underscores is exactly what we spoke about before we had a chat with Jeanette about Israeli prison techniques, about how places like Ketziot are used as testing grounds for torture techniques, the disco room as a method of torture was developed and refined and honed by the Israelis in their prisons against Palestinians, and it's only once they've gotten these torture techniques down to almost this sick art that they're then used more widely on people like flotilla activists and human rights activists and aid workers and all the rest who are detained and jailed illegally in military prisons by Israel. So that's something we chatted about before we went live today, and I think it's totally right to mention it.
Absolutely. I know I've been reading various media reports. The media was actually better than I expected it to be, although they were a bit patronising with some interviews. But I think one of the things that I looked at was you had no belongings when you arrived at the airport, did you? Can you talk about the lead up to what happened when you're on the boat? Because I think you didn't end up going to an Israeli prison, but we're speaking off air about the military being quite manipulative.
Yeah, so it wasn't just the physical torture and the violence. No. It was also this level of, psychological game playing that we had with the Israelis, and that came in a lot of forms. But one of the clearest, I think, was Like those deprivations of liberty. I mean, our belongings were confiscated. We had our passports taken off us, and we weren't allowed to have those passports back for many days. We were technically, when we were dropped off in Greece, we were technically there illegally because we didn't have our passports and we hadn't gone through immigration. So the Israelis obviously put us in very precarious positions. But what we spoke about was at the very end of our detention on the prison boat, on the Israeli prison boat, we were woken up at dawn with soldiers and guns and sort of a bit of a shock and awe moment where they all just burst into our enclosure and started dragging people out. We had about 180 people or so on board, and we were basically given the instruction that if we were to come, what they said, if we were to come peaceably, which is to put our hands in the air and walk willingly with them, that we would be dropped off and deported to a foreign country. We weren't told which one. Or if we you know, stuck around and refused to go willingly, that we would be taken to Israel where we'd be jailed. It was a complete psychological manipulation. The goal was to split the group and divide the group of activists and sort of make it seem as though, you know, we could cause them less trouble. Yeah. And get a better deal out of it. And so there were about 150 people who either decided to go willingly or were dragged off early by the Israelis. And there were maybe 35-ish of us who decided at the end of the day, we're not going willingly.
We've got about a minute left.
And that's the point at which we were taken by the Israelis. We were restrained. I had, before I knew what was happening, I had a life jacket over my head. They pulled the cord and then they threw me out of the boat. And that's when I landed on a Greek Coast Guard boat. And that's the moment we were home free. Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, and that really goes to show the manipulation that happened because you didn't know what was going on.
No, absolutely not.
Thank you so much for coming onto the program, and I was so happy to have you here on the show to talk about this. And it's you and the rest of the crew are always very welcome to come here into the show.
Thanks very much.
Anyway, it's approximately 4:57. And we're going to be going out now with our theme song, Blackfella, Whitefella by the Rumpy Band. And it's goodbye from Marissa. Stay tuned every Monday from 4 to 5 for the Do and Time show. And go to Mole Creek on the weekend. Sorry, Joe, I couldn't read it out. But I'll talk about it next time. Thanks a lot. Bye.
As long as you a true fella, as long as you a real fella. All the people of different races with different lives in different places, it doesn't matter what your name is, we got to have lots of changes. We need more brothers if we're to make it. We need more sisters if we're to save it. Are you the one who's gonna stand up and be counted? Are you the one who's gonna be there when we're shouting? Are you the one who's always ready with a helping hand? Are you the one who understands this family plan? Black fella, white fella, yellow fella, any fella, it doesn't matter what you color, as long as you a true fella. All the people of different races with different lives in different places, it doesn't matter which religions, it's all the same. Whether ship is sinking, we need more brothers if we're to make it.
You've been listening to a 3CR podcast produced in the studios of independent community radio station 3CR in Melbourne, Australia. For more information, go to allthews.3cr.org.au.